Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Shahid Buttar of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, who discusses his objections to provisions of the National Defense Authorization Act, which gives the government authority to indefinitely imprison American citizens and non-citizens alike without charge or trial. Mark Hayes of Public Citizen, who talks about protest actions being organized to demand the overturning of the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision that allows for unlimited spending by corporations and election campaigns. And Cindy Cohn of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who explains the importance of her group's recent court victory that revived a lawsuit against warrantless government surveillance of American citizens. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A U.S. Army investigation of a 2010 drone attack that killed 15 civilians in Afghanistan revealed that a civilian contractor played a key role in the airstrike by providing analysis of video data coming from the Predator drone. The contractor worked for SAIC, a private company in Virginia, with a $49 million contract with the Air Force to analyze drone video and other intelligence data from Afghanistan. The civilian contractor involved in the 2010 drone strike supervised other analysts at the U.S. Air Force Special Operations Command Center in Florida. An Army captain, using the video analysis provided by the contractor, ordered the drone strike that killed 15 innocent Afghan men, women, and children. The rapid expansion of U.S. drone attacks in war zones has placed hundreds of civilian contractors in the operational decision-making process in military assaults, sometimes referred to as the kill chain. The increased role of civilians is now coming into conflict with U.S. law, which states military force must be authorized through a formal chain of command. In the case of CIA operations, covert action must be approved by top civilian officials or a presidential finding. Civilians in military operational roles are not subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which can be used to prosecute war crimes. An appeals court in Ecuador has upheld an $18 billion judgment against Chevron for environmental damage resulting from oil drilling and toxic waste dumped in the Amazon rainforest. Texaco, which merged with Chevron in 2001, began pumping crude oil from the Ecuadorian Amazon in the mid-1970s until it turned over its oil operations to Ecuador's state oil company. For nearly 20 years, Ecuadorian citizens have pursued a class action suit against Texaco, seeking compensation for the damage oil pollution inflicted on human health and the environment. In early 2011, a trial court in Ecuador ordered Texaco to pay $8.6 billion in damages, but the judgment doubled when Chevron refused to apologize for its actions. Chevron claims it has no cleanup responsibility since Texaco signed a $40 million cleanup agreement with the Ecuadorian government in the late 1990s. In another setback for the oil giant, a U.S. appeals court overturned a decision that blocked the collection of the judgment from Chevron. Plaintiffs in Ecuador praised the court ruling, stating, "The ruling confirms and ratifies that the company polluted and affected the Amazon." In the November 2012 presidential election, Florida, with 29 electoral votes, is a must-win swing state for Republicans. Barack Obama narrowly won the Sunshine State in 2008, but faces an uphill battle as one-time supporters question his record on the economy. In August, the Republicans will hold their nominating convention in Tampa, Florida's third-largest city. The Democrats, hoping to be competitive in the conservative South, will hold their convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, another swing state. Democratic strategists are concerned about Florida's growing population of Latino voters who supported Obama 4 years ago, but in 2010 embraced Republicans, including Governor Rick Scott and U.S. Senator Mario Rubio, a Cuban American. The outcome in Florida could be decided by the votes of moderate suburban women who backed Obama in 2008. 4 years ago, Tampa graphic designer April Smith was a big Obama booster, but is now ignoring campaign emails. She wants better answers from Obama on the economy and is troubled that the White House did not have a plan to address unemployment until recently. Smith's assessment of Obama captures the mood of many one-time supporters, a feeling of being let down after such high expectations. But Republicans are worried that once the general election campaign begins in earnest, His personal popularity will change the equation. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
On the last day of 2011, President Obama signed the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, which mandates that all accused terrorists be indefinitely imprisoned in military rather than in the civilian court system. But most alarmingly, the measure also empowers the current and all future presidents to indefinitely imprison U.S. citizens and non-citizens suspected of engaging in terrorism without charge or trial. As he signed the bill, President Obama issued a signing statement saying that he had serious reservations about the indefinite imprisonment provisions, but the statement only applies to how Mr. Obama would apply the law and will not be binding on his successors in the White House. But Michigan Democratic Senator Carl Levin disclosed that the White House had objected to earlier efforts to insert language in the bill that would have specifically exempted U.S. citizens from the indefinite detention provision. 10 years after the U.S. opened its prison for terrorist suspects at the Guantanamo Bay U.S. Naval Base in Cuba, other provisions in the National Defense Authorization Act will place obstacles in the way of closing the facility that President Obama pledged to do within the year when he took office in 2009. Further, the measure effectively prevents the release of 89 men held in Guantanamo who have been unanimously cleared by all levels of U.S. law enforcement and intelligence agencies. Your reporter spoke with Shahid Buttar, Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, who discusses his objections to the National Defense Authorization Act's indefinite detention provisions and effective ways in which grassroots activism can overturn the law.
The detention provisions center on two sections of the bill, one of which requires military detention without trial in the event of accusation, and that section is walled off from applying to citizens. The other section allows military detention without trial, and that is not limited in the sense that it can apply to citizens. And President Obama, to his credit, when signing the bill, which I absolutely oppose and think was a constitutional travesty, especially from a constitutional law professor, he did announce a signing statement, but it's a very limited help. He basically said in his signing statement that he and his administration will not use the detention provisions with respect to U.S. citizens, but there's nothing to keep the next president from choosing otherwise. And that's the danger with passing laws like this, to paraphrase the words of Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson in a seminal case from the 1950s exploring the limits of executive power. Executive power is like a loaded weapon lying around for some future president to find an excuse to use it or to come up with one. And the danger of signing into law a bill that entitles the government to deny Fifth Amendment rights to due process, Sixth Amendment rights to trial, to, through that power, infringe on First Amendment rights to speech and assembly, and Eighth Amendment rights to be free from cruel and unusual punishment. It is easily the worst thing that has happened to the Constitution in the last 10 years, and I say that including the Patriot Act. I do think this was substantially worse. And one of the worst things about it is that most Americans have never even heard about it because there's been essentially a corporate media blackout with respect to these concerns.
Now, I've heard there's at least one U.S. senator that said he was ready to put in a provision that would take U.S. citizens out of indefinite detention provisions altogether, but the Obama administration rejected that option, giving you the impression that the White House is talking out of both sides of its mouth, saying, you know, in the signing statement they wouldn't apply it, but apparently they didn't want to rule it out legally through putting some plank in the legislation that would have prohibited it.
Yeah, one of the problems with the secret process, and that's what led to this bill being passed, was an entirely secret process with not even a single congressional hearing. One of the problems with the secret process is it gets really hard to pin the tail on the donkey. And so Senator Levin, the Democrat who chairs the Armed Services Committee, who introduced the bill and is its principal proponent, he alleges, without support, though there's no documentary or public record to know who said this, he claims that the administration did not want to go so far as to excluding citizens from the detention provisions. Now, many members of Congress have actually attempted to assert that position. Senator Udall was one of the, and Senator Feinstein have each taken that position. Senator Leahy, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, has taken that position. So you have the chairs of the Intelligence and the Judiciary Committee both backing the idea that citizens should not be subject to these powers, and they've backed a bill, the Due Process Treatment Act, that's been introduced in the Senate, and there's a corresponding bill in the House. Neither of them will move with the same alacrity that the Defense Authorization Act did, however, because they're not must-pass bills. Again, the secrecy with which this process happened is maybe not as offensive as the subject matter of the bill, but they're both very offensive, and I think they both present many reasons to be very concerned, both for the future of the Republic, but also to get down to what that means, the essential liberty that has enabled the civil society of which our nation has long been proud and which has long inspired the rest of the world to follow our example.
Shahid, I imagine you and your staff at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee have been talking with other civil liberties groups around the country to figure out some strategy how to most effectively challenge and overturn these provisions that codify indefinite detention for Americans and non-American citizens. Where are things headed? Is this something that will eventually be decided by the Supreme Court, you think?
I don't think so. Actually, there's at least three different tracks on which the challenges will proceed. There'll be a litigation track, so many groups will go to the courts to try to find relief. There will be a policy track, which is to say the bills in the Senate and the House, and there will certainly be a lot of opportunities for people to voice their support to their congressional representatives to support those bills to, again, make clear and change the law so that citizens are not subject to indefinite detention. And then third, there's a grassroots track. The key, I think, as always in any policy area, is grassroots action. And it's important that people raise their voices through any channels available, whether that's shooting a YouTube video with your friends in a satire, posting that to get the word out, or whether that's visiting your congressperson and their office when they're back in your district, whether that's writing an op-ed, or whether that's staging a protest. One strategy we'll be pushing a lot is the opportunity to seek symbolic resolutions from city councils and state legislatures to keep the issue in the press and to generate a groundswell for a legislative fix to repeal the detention provisions of the NDAA. And I think that while Congress might be out to lunch and the executive branch might be off the rails, we, the people of the United States, are still sovereign, and we have a lot of opportunities to raise our voice at the layers of government where we still have a voice.
That was Shahid Buttar, Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Find links to additional information and analysis about indefinite detention issues on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. January 20th marks the second anniversary of the Citizens United case, in which the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that corporations and unions may give unlimited donations to elect or defeat political candidates based on the interpretation of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution that corporations are people with the same free speech rights as individuals. Some groups like Public Citizen, Common Cause, and People for the American Way, joined by grassroots groups like Move to Amend, have been working since the Supreme Court decision to advocate for a constitutional amendment restricting the definition of personhood to human beings and to roll back the power of corporations. These groups, under the banner of United for the People, will be organizing protest actions on January 20th and 21st to condemn the court's Citizens United decision and call for constitutional reform to take back democracy from corporate rule. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mark Hayes, coordinator of Public Citizen's Democracy is for People campaign. He explains how and why the campaign is working toward a constitutional amendment and the role of the Occupy Wall Street movement in raising awareness around this issue.
Around January 21st, the second anniversary of Citizens United, our organizations are planning grassroots actions that demonstrate the broad support for constitutional reform from people across the country. And we're doing that in a couple different ways. First, each organization involved in this effort is planning actions that fit with their particular campaign effort, whether it's focusing on aspects of the judiciary and their role in this problem, whether it's pushing for local and state resolutions calling for amendment, which is something that Public Citizen is doing, Move to Amend, another group called Free Speech for People. But above all, we're working in a coordinated fashion to show that this movement is broad. So one way we're doing that is we have an umbrella network called United for the People. And that umbrella network seeks to show that despite some of the differences we have in scope and tactics on exactly how to approach and amendment work, we're united in the ideal that this has been such a game changer, we really need to push for constitutional reform together to restore the balance.
You know, despite earlier efforts by many groups, it's really the Occupy movement that brought this opposition to corporate personhood into the limelight. A sign held up by a woman in New York at a rally early on and that later went viral said, "I'll believe corporations are people when the government executes one." So is Occupy part of your efforts around January 21st, or are they doing their own events in their own cities?
I think it's a mixture of both. I think, first of all, what's really exciting about the Occupy movement, and I think what's galvanized so many people across the country in response to it, is that, you know, I can't speak for that movement, but I know for me personally and for those that work in sort of the progressive and independent political community that the sentiments there, specifically, this economy doesn't work for people and this government doesn't work for people, it works for Wall Street, are ones that a lot of people share. And their response to the problem of corporate money in politics and corporate domination of our democracy, I think, rings true with a lot of us. And so, thematically, there's a lot that we share. So we definitely stand in solidarity with them, and we believe that the work that our organization is doing and other organizations are doing to push for amendment are solidary actions, if you will, working along towards some of the same objectives.
Mark Hayes, it's very hard to get a constitutional amendment passed. Are there other ways your organizations are working to rein in the power of the corporations?
You know, at Public Citizen, we and many of our allies support a spectrum of responses to the Citizens United decision. I mean, the best way to think about it is what we need to do in the short term, the medium term, and the long term. You know, to begin with, there are things we can do right now to shine a spotlight on some of this influx of corporate money that's pouring into our political system. So passing laws at the state and federal level to force disclosure from some of these new donors will go a long way towards giving us the information we need to understand what's actually happening. So that's a first step. The second step we can do is sort of throw some sand in the gears and force greater accountability from some of these new corporate donors. So with that in mind, we and a number of different organizations are seeking to pass legislation or new rules within the corporate governance sector or within the SEC that would basically force corporations to seek approval from their shareholders and investors before spending this money that they now have access to for political uses or campaign uses. But ultimately, we're seeking a constitutional amendment because the court's decision has changed the landscape. It is now very difficult, if not impossible, to pass legislation that would restrict this kind of corporate funding or other similar kinds of donations in the political process. It's also very difficult to litigate our way out of it, not only because of the court's composition, but because of the way in which the judicial system uses precedent. So even if we were able to get a case to the court that could potentially overturn this precedent, it would take a great deal of time and a lot of stars would have to align. It's not out of the question, but it's something that's difficult. But I think the most compelling point for pushing for a constitutional amendment is not only because it's a solution that's necessary, it's also a solution that stands to really give us the fuel we need to build the democratic movement to take back our democracy. This is an idea that has galvanized people's attention towards the issue of campaign finance reform and corporate money in politics, arguably like none we've seen in many years. It takes the issue to a new level when people realize it's not just about tinkering with the machinery, it's really about the nature of our democracy. So that's one key reason we're pushing for a constitutional amendment as a focal point for our overarching efforts. And, you know, frankly, it could take a while, but many progressive efforts to change society, to build a new path for our democracy take time. We've seen that in other issue areas. So in this respect, we're really just the beginning of a similar effort.
That was Mark Hayes, coordinator of Public Citizens' Democracy is for People campaign. To learn more about the protest actions being organized for January 20th and 21st, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Electronic Frontier Foundation launched its landmark Juul versus National Security Agency lawsuit on behalf of AT&T customers in September 2008, with the goal of stopping the Bush administration's massive warrantless dragnet surveillance of American citizens' communications and communications records. Evidence in the case included documents provided by a former AT&T technician named Mark Klein, who charged that AT&T had routed copies of Internet traffic to a secret room in their Folsom Street, San Francisco facility controlled by the NSA. The Bush and then the Obama administration have both attempted to dismiss the case based mostly on the contention that they were immune from the suit because it would require the government to disclose privileged state secrets. But on December 29th, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals revived the case and returned Juul v. NSA to the district court to proceed. However, the three-judge panel of the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court upheld the dismissal of another case that sought to hold telecommunications companies liable for their participation in the surveillance program, citing Congress's decision to grant them retroactive immunity. In addition to suing the government agencies participating in the domestic surveillance program, the suit targeted the individuals responsible for creating and then authorizing the wiretap operation. Individuals named in the suit include former President George W. Bush, former Vice President Dick Cheney, Cheney's former Chief of Staff David Addington, former Attorney General and White House Counsel Alberto Gonzalez, and others in the administration. Your reporter spoke with Cindy Cohn, legal director with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who explains the importance of her group's recent court victory, reviving the lawsuit against government surveillance, and the next steps in the case.
The decision by the Bush administration that they could surveil Americans without seeking warrants or other legal process was hidden for many years, but revealed to the country in 2005. And, you know, our case is one of a number of cases that were brought to try to stop the spying. And, you know, we believe that the spying, we have evidence, that the spying is kind of happening on two levels. There's targeted surveillance, and that's what the president admitted. He said, you know, if you're talking to a member of Al-Qaeda, we want to be listening. And that's, you know, that's talking about very targeted surveillance at people who may have communications with people that the government suspects are involved in terrorism. And those cases have been brought by the ACLU, and the Center for Constitutional Rights has one as well. And there are a couple others floating around, including one called the Al-Haramain Islamic Foundation case out here in the Ninth Circuit that has been quite successful so far. But we were concerned with something else that kind of got revealed at about the same time, and that was that the government was engaging not just in targeted surveillance, but in wholesale surveillance of Americans and getting access to the communications and communications records of millions of ordinary people, in addition to the targeted surveillance that they're talking with. And what we think, although some of this is unclear, is that what's happening is the government is scooping up the communications of basically all of us or most of us, and then using sophisticated sorting technologies, semantic traffic analyzers and things like that, to do the targeting that they've admitted. And we think that this first step, this government having copies of everybody's communications, is itself a major problem under both the Constitution and the surveillance laws. We started off by filing a case against the phone companies, and I'm sure your listeners remember the big fight over retroactive immunity for the phone companies. But when it looked like the phone companies were likely going to get some version of a free pass from the government, we brought a lawsuit, the Juul case, against the government directly for the exact same spying. So there's kind of a tortured history here. It's been about 6 years, but what the Ninth Circuit said on right at the end of the year is that we can go forward with our lawsuit against the government, which is really good news. Our goal all along has been to stop the spying. I think that the phone company should be held liable too, but I'll stop the spying any way I can.
Well, where does the case go from here, Cindy, now that the case has been reinstated? Where is the Electronic Frontier Foundation going to go in terms of challenging the surveillance? And I guess this would be a good time also to sort of update ourselves on where the Obama administration has taken the surveillance program.
Yeah, the Obama administration has been horrible, despite the pretty center, important role that reengaging the rule of law to protect our civil liberties generally, and specifically about surveillance. I mean, Obama campaigned on this issue pretty consistently and pretty hard. They have been horrible. They have not only not stopped the spying and not stopped defending both it and the secrecy arguments that the Bush administration started, but they've actually in some ways been even more aggressive in their legal arguments than we saw under Bush, and that was a surprise to us and troubling to us. The government has the opportunity to appeal this further and try to take this question either on to what's called an en banc panel of the Ninth Circuit, which is 11 judges rather than the three that we had, or to the U.S. Supreme Court. They may do that, although for a couple of technical reasons, I doubt that that's the decision that they will make. Instead, I think the case will go back down to the district court, we'll move on to the next phase. The judge who had handled the case before, Judge Vaughn Walker here in the Northern District of California, has retired, so we'll get a new judge, and then we'll go forward now. We would like to quickly get to the merits of this case, but I strongly suspect that the government will once again try to raise its state secrets arguments here to try to get the case thrown out, and that we will have to, this will make the third time, we will have to brief why it is the state secrets privilege doesn't apply to these cases. Now, that's my guess. I'm hopeful that that won't be the tack that the Obama administration takes, but that's certainly what they did the last time. You know, maybe the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. Maybe they've got a different argument than I have. Maybe they think that the four or five different statutes that Congress has passed to prevent surveillance without warrants are just passé now in this modern technology. Well, then they need to be honest with the American people. We need to have this discussion, and then we need to let the courts decide. Well, is this legal or isn't it? And I think ordinary people need to make their voices heard. There's a sense when we talk to members of Congress that people don't care about this anymore, that people are over it, that this was something people were worried about under Bush, but now that Obama's in office, they trust him. They don't think that he could possibly do anything wrong. I mean, I don't know what the arguments are, but I can tell you that when we talk to members of Congress and members of the administration, they don't think the American people care. And I think that's wrong. But I think it's up to people to make their voices heard.
That was Cindy Cohn, legal director with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. For more information on the foundation's surveillance lawsuit and related news about the erosion of civil liberties, visit our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.